Welcome back to the program. It's almost been a universal truth since Horace Greeley first uttered the words, "Go West, young man," that the West offers opportunity and fortune. Today, all of that has changed. For many, particularly the children of immigrants from China and India, the decision to go east, to return east, has been its own road to riches. Back in 2008, New York Times columnist Anand Girhardis did exactly that, heading back to India to what he saw as the frontier of the future. Anand Girhardis writes the Currents column for the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times Online. He's a native of Cleveland, a graduate of the University of Michigan. He worked in Bombay as a management consultant and began reporting from the city for the Herald Tribune and the New York Times. It is my pleasure to welcome Anand Girhardis here to talk about his work, India Calling, an intimate portrait of a nation's remaking. Anand, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here. Talk a little bit about your decision to go east back in 2008.
You know, it was what began as an almost kind of whimsical decision that then saw many other people kind of coming upon the same whim, and the whim kind of became a force in the world. For me, I was a senior in college and was thinking about what to do with my life, as all seniors in college are. And the idea of being a writer had appealed to me, but it's not very clear how you become a writer necessarily. And so I thought I would go somewhere challenging in the world and do whatever job I could do there and you know, kind of figure things out from there. So India immediately came to me because I had grown up with Indian parents in the United States. And India in the 80s and 90s had always been, as I was growing up, a place that was kind of stagnant and dead and full of tragedies on the evening news, and not a place that I had wanted to be associated with. But by the time my decision in 2003 had rolled around, the world had begun to change, and I had caught glimmers of something kind of breaking out in India. And I thought, why not?
To what extent did what you found when you got to India kind of remain consistent to the expectations you had about what was happening in the country?
You know, I had grown up, we all, you know, create pictures of things in our minds based on whatever information we have. And as an immigrant family, as a child of immigrants, you often conjure up the country that you are ancestrally from based on some family anecdotes shared over breakfast and dinners, and based on the occasional kind of once in 2 year visits we took to India, based on what you read every now and then, what I learned in school about India. And from that, there was a picture of the country as this kind of beautiful, great ancient civilization that had kind of tumbled into stagnancy and irrelevance and stasis. In the time of my childhood. And when I arrived in 2003, I realized that although certainly much of the old was still present, something profoundly new was happening to the country that totally made it another kind of place from the place that I confidently thought I knew.
And did you like that place that you found? Did you like it because it was different in some ways from what you had conjured up?
I think I liked it because if I go back for a second and think about what I didn't like about the India that I had visited as a child, it was, above all, this sense that people could not become the fullest possible expressions of themselves. So let's start right off with women, which is about, you know, half the country.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of other people in a not much better position than women either, people who were poor, people who were low caste, people who were servants, people from the villages instead of the cities. And it was when I came back, the idea that seemed to have kind of cracked into India and to be pushing in further and further by the time I got there in the 2000s was this idea that you can become whoever you want to be. Now, that doesn't mean everybody invented themselves already, but the idea of reinvention, a kind of Tocquevillian spirit, you might say, had pushed its way into the country and was beginning to remake large swaths of Indian life.
Consistent with that, and side by side, was this real change, though, you write about, in the moral and ethical landscape. Talk about that.
It's interesting, you know, when India gained independence from the British, the class of Indians who replaced the British, running the country, running the companies that the British used to run, etc., were very British Indians. They spoke with British accents. They often went to school in Britain. They would have, you know, they would love having high tea, played golf, and that class tended to have a very a kind of rigid, in a way more Western derived sense of moral right and wrong. And I think what's happening now in India is, without saying it's a better or worse system of morality, a system of morality more rooted in what some people would say is the Hindu worldview or just an Indian worldview that is much more what scholars call a context-sensitive morality, which is less about the Western emphasis on something being true in all cases and right and wrong in all cases, and more about what's the context, what's the right moral solution in this context and what's the right one in that context. What that also allows is a kind of ethical flexibility in the kinds of business decisions. There's a lot of business leaders today who don't come from that anglicized class, who are doing very well, and who I think believe and would argue that they're doing great things for India. They have to do some dirty things to get there. It's all part of it. And that's an important shift in the country.
And did you respond to this both viscerally as an individual or looked at it from a detached perspective as a reporter?
I think my job was obviously to be a reporter, and I set out to do that. And I think I did that for a while. And what occurred to me halfway, I would say, through my journey was that I had access to this kind of well of insights about India, not academic insights or data-based insights, but there were just certain things I knew in the gut about India by virtue of having Indian parents and Indian grandparents and Indian cousins that I wasn't using in my stories. But something in me knew who these people were more than I let on in my articles. And I think I started thinking about how can I use that? How can I access that? And when I did, I think for me it was a turning point. And I think, you know, you have to be careful as a returned second-generation emigre writing about the country because you have your own biases the way anybody else does. But I think it can also give you very special access to a country that other people don't have by virtue of your in-betweenness.
What did you see in terms of the generational differences, your parents' generation, those that were still there, versus the younger generation that you write about that had truly embraced this idea of modernity?
In many ways, I think the generational fault line is the most important fault line in India today. If you spend time in relatively poor villages with 25-year-olds, and then you go to meet young, rich 25-year-olds in the city, you will hear in their language, as different as they are, I mean, they live at different extremes of wealth and even sometimes personhood, but there's a kind of similar spirit that you will actually find despite their class differences. And that is because, in many ways, the change that has happened over the last 20 years, say, is so dramatic that the only way to adapt to it is to be young enough to know nothing else. I think people who are 45 and 50 or 60 today, they can adapt to certain things. But so many things have changed overnight in these years that it's very difficult for them to kind of totally become different kinds of people. So it's sometimes sad that the only way for people to kind of the way a country changes in a process like this is churning. It's some people kind of fading out and new people rising up. But adaptation for the older generation is very, very difficult.
As difficult as that adaptation is, what you write about is a generation that has trouble with the adaptation but doesn't push back against it, that doesn't fight it, that doesn't necessarily resent it.
That's right. And I think, you know, there's a feeling right now in India among a certain proportion of the population that a country in which the self had always had so many constraints on it from the government, from the caste, from class, from bad economic policy, the self is now breaking out and the idea that the self can make its destiny, is establishing itself. And that's the kind of mood of the country. And you find that mood even among people who have not yet done this, because it's certainly the case that most Indians are still desperately poor, two-thirds. But you find this change of spirit even with them. And I think it's in that frame where everybody feels some shadow of a possibility to change their destiny, that people tend to be willing to kind of see what the future can bring them.
Is that in measure because the past was so difficult, because there was so much poverty, because just the hope of opportunity in and of itself overcomes the resistance to change?
It is, and it's, you know, I think what's new now is partly the material fact of opportunity today that is different from the fact of scarcity before. You know, one of the things that's very striking when I was growing up is you'd arrive in, we would fly from Cleveland, Ohio to New York, and then from New York we'd get on a plane that would go to India, maybe through London or whatever. And then already in New York, all the Indians on the Air India flight would be like pushing and pulling for seats on the plane that were already assigned seats. And it was just the mentality of a country that had been kind of programmed to think that there's not enough of things. And you still have a bit of that, but there's certainly a class of Indians now who can feel very confident that there's plenty of things. Now, that's, again, not true for most Indians. But countries have kind of changes of spirit before those changes kind of touch everybody. And that's what India is in the middle of right now.
Is there a fear, is there a concern that things could, if not go back to the way they were, at least slow down in a way that people would be afraid of?
I think obviously, I mean, you know, with any economy, things can slow down. The growth rates are so fast right now that the only direction to go from here is probably down. That said, it depends on your theory of growth. I mean, if you just look at this from an economic growth GDP thing, of course it can go up, down, left and right. But what I witnessed in India was people beginning to get a different idea of themselves. The idea of themselves was an idea of people who can make things happen, who doesn't need the government, doesn't need family, but can just go and make things happen. Once people start to get that idea, coupled with the idea of just aspiration and wanting a better life, that idea spreads virally. I say in the book that, you know, to desire a washing machine is free. To buy one costs money, but to desire one is free. And those wishes are spreading. And I actually think that once they spread and keep spreading, the government and businesses and everybody will be under growing pressure to deliver on them. So in some ways, there's a virtuous cycle here where aspirations become a kind of material fact that no one can ignore.
Is there discussion about trying to meld some of the cultural roots that you talk about, some of the things that you saw, you know, as you grew up as a child there, to bring those into balance in a different kind of way with this rush towards economic modernity?
That's a great question. You know, I think one of the things that's happening is there's so much excitement about the new that everyone has forgotten that this is a really old civilization with some extraordinary contributions. And in a way, you can't blame people because people are very excited and people are seizing what was denied to them before. But at the same time, I think one of the big questions that India faces is how do you take what is wrong with tradition, bad with tradition, what in tradition limited you? How do you purge that without throwing out everything that's good with tradition, too? How do you kind of distinguish between good traditions and bad traditions? Who is doing that distinguishing? I think, for example, the Indian press should probably play a better role in kind of helping think through these choices. One of the things people don't realize about what's happening in India, and I would say in China as well, is that change is happening, social change, not just economic change, on a scale that the West has never seen. You literally have a society where, you know, you're pretty much a complete male patriarchy not that many years ago, And fast forward a few years, and the Supreme Court has decriminalized homosexuality, which still hasn't, you know, convincingly happened in the U.S. So the kinds of rapid social change that you're having is extraordinary, and people are in many ways excited, but also quite flustered by such change.
Flustered and fearful?
It depends who you ask. I think the people who are fearful, above all, are the people who made their choices in that earlier world, felt that they knew more or less what India would look like as they grew up, and made their choices to work for the government or to live here or live there. And this rapid modernity in many ways unravels sometimes people's choices and makes them retroactively unwise. And that is very difficult for people. One story that really stuck out for me was a guy I met called Bairam Harda, who was a rat catcher in the Bombay municipal government. And his story was that he began actually as a cha-cha, professional cha-cha dancer in Bollywood. And now, this was not today when Bollywood's a kind of global industry. This was the 70s. And his father looked at him one day and said, look, this is a socialist country. This Bollywood thing is never going to go anywhere. You should get a secure job in the city government. So he quit Bollywood, and he joined the civil service of the city, and he became a rat catcher. And he was so good that instead of transferring him around all the departments, he just stayed a rat catcher, and he was promoted to being like the best rat catcher in Bombay. And that may have seemed like a wise choice for the first few years. And then lo and behold, India flipped, and a socialist country became capitalist. People stopped wanting to work in the civil service, and they all moved to the private sector. And this guy who had kind of fixed his dreams and plans with certain assumptions about what was growing and not growing and what was secure and what was not secure, saw all his assumptions thrown on the floor. And people like that can feel quite bereft.
Is there a sense of respect for tradition among the younger generation that has so embraced and is so caught up in modernity?
There is. You know, I think one of the things that's very striking to me, and I think we're only beginning to understand this about the Indian process of modernization, is that it is not at all as disruptive and kind of cataclysmic as this journey has been, you know, whether it's China, Russia, other places. It's sometimes too slow for people's tastes. But with that slowness, I think one of the things that's come, particularly with young people, is that there's this embrace of the new. Sometimes, you know, even the new, such as drugs and drink and hooking up and all these things. And at the same time, these same people embracing this stuff will still regularly do their family dinners with 12 people, asking them why they aren't married yet and all of that. And there's a kind of tolerance for doing both. And I often tell people this, that I know a lot of people who do drugs in India, and most of them also regularly have huge family dinners several times a week that most Americans would never put up with. And it's a really interesting thing about the nature of modernity in India, that people often don't feel compelled to choose between being modern and traditional. They're very comfortably both.
And finally, do you think there's anything that the West, that Americans specifically, can learn from that?
I think there is. You know, I think you don't, as a society, I think the American tendency is often to pick your virtue and then elevate that virtue to, you know, so whether it's freedom or whether it's justice or whatever it is, and kind of organize the entire world around that one idea. I think, you know, there's a lot that India can learn from the West, and there's a lot that the West can learn from India. And I think one thing that the West, and particularly America, can certainly learn from India is the kind of multiplicity of truths, and the fact that it's okay if certain different multiple things and even conflictual things are simultaneously true. For example, if you think about our political discourse in this country today, it's probably true that freedom and economic freedom and the government being minimal is a good thing to a certain extent. And it's probably true that taking care of the least fortunate is a good thing. And the fact that we have so few people who are comfortable saying that both those things are probably true is a testimony to a way of thinking that's become quite entrenched here, that I think is pretty unhelpful, no matter where you stand.
Anand Gheradas, his book is India Calling, an intimate portrait of a nation's remaking. Anand, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.